Hi, good evening, good morning, good afternoon. Greg Barth back with another edition of Noir on the Radio. And joining me for tonight's show is author Brian Stoddart, who is connecting all the way from Queenstown, New Zealand, probably about as far away from Kentucky as you can get where I am and still be on the same planet. At first, a little about our guest. Brian Stoddart is a writer of fiction and nonfiction who's based in Queenstown, New Zealand. Born and educated a Kiwi, he's worked around the world as an academic, university executive, aid and development consultant, broadcaster, commentator, and blogger. Imadris Miasma was the first in a series of books set in 1920s, Madras in India, and featuring Superintendent Chris Lafanu. The Palampur Predicament was the second, and A Straight Settlement appeared in 2016 as the third. Brian Stoddart, welcome to Noir on the Radio. Thanks for coming on the show.
Hi, Greg, and you're quite right. It's fabulous to be connecting from halfway around the world into Kentucky. That's amazing.
It's amazing what technology can do. So Brian, I barely scratched the surface on your bio. Can you take a minute and tell us about yourself for any listeners that may be unfamiliar with you and your work?
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity. As you say, I grew up and was educated first here in New Zealand, then went to Australia and did a PhD on the history of modern history of India. Did that from the University of Western Australia. That took me into India, obviously, a lot. I lived there on and off for about 6 years or so, probably. That in turn took me into the rest of Asia and around the world. Teaching as an academic, that I had a year or so in Canada teaching at the University of British Columbia, taught all over Australia, ran an offshore campus for an Australian university in Malaysia, and then I got into university management really by mistake and ended up as a university president in Australia. Managed to escape from that, and then, as you mentioned, went into aid and development work on higher education reform. So that took me into Southeast Asia. I had 3 years in Cambodia, and I had a year in Jordan, and wonderfully, close to a year in Syria, immediately before all the horrors that we now see going on around us. So I've been very lucky. My training and my career took me into a lot of very different places.
Wow, what a fascinating story, Brian. Your novels, they take place during the kind of the post-World War I beginning decline of the British colonial period in India. The 1920s. What drew you to that period and location?
Well, I think there's a couple of influences, Greg. The first is the obvious one in that my original PhD research work was in Madras in the 1920s and the 1930s, so I knew that period very well. And because I'd lived in Madras a lot, that was a great sort of evocative place to put a series of stories. The other influence is a little bit more indirect, and there's probably a couple of dimensions to it. The first, like everybody else, I think I'd read a lot of crime fiction. And I've been partly because of my background, I think I've always been attracted to crime fiction set in what seem like different places. You know, there's a lot of stuff set in London. There's a lot of stuff set in New York, all of which I enjoy. But I also really learn from things that are set elsewhere, whether it's Africa or in Asia or through Europe somewhere. And that was part of it. And the other bit is that it allows me to treat the crime fiction is also a vehicle for, in a sense, social history. It allows me to tell stories about India in a very different way, but explain a lot about what was happening in India at that stage. in a crime fiction way. And I suppose as a small adjunct, in all honesty, I was very skeptical that I'd ever write any fiction. I started writing as an academic. It was all non-fiction. I always tried to connect to wider audiences, but I never really thought I would get to the creative fictional end of it. And then I started to write some very different things. I wrote a biography of a very interesting guy. He was Anglo-Italian who worked in Madras in the 20s and really from about 1900 through to the 1930s. I never thought I'd do a biography, and that worked. I was sitting when I was in Damascus working there. I started to keep a travel diary, but I then turned that into a memoir, which I never thought I'd do. And there it was. So I thought, well, I've never thought I'd write crime fiction, but I might as well. And in that sense, knowing the stories and knowing the period and knowing the location made India and Madras a relatively easy choice. And it's worked out reasonably well. I mean, that's a very long answer to a good question, but it'll give you a sense of where some of the impulses came from.
Yeah, no, I think that's interesting for the audience, because one of the things that we see, you know, this being noir on the radio, a lot of noir fiction, you know, classically is set in L.A., New York, you know, metropolitan settings. But I see a lot of exciting things coming from Crime Wave Press where, you know, you're in more exotic locations. And it creates a lot of interest. There's a lot of Swedish and Nordic noir coming out these days, and rural noir. So it's it really adds some depth and complexity to the genre. You have three novels out currently featuring Superintendent Lafano, all from Crime Wave Press, and they're Madras Miasma, A Palimpsest Predicament, and A Straight Settlement. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about the character, Lafano?
Well, Lafano, I chose the name because it was to make him a little bit different. What I was looking for was a character who was a little bit sympathetic towards the Indian nationalist cause, which was starting to grow seriously in the 1920s, of course, because of the work of Mahatma Gandhi. I wanted him to have a background that was a little different from the rest of the Indian civil service. In a sense, I wanted him to be a little bit of an outsider, so that making him sympathetic to India rather than ruling India was somehow to set up this idea about change going on in India itself, on the move towards independence that finally came in 1947. So because of that, I've set him up. He went off to the First War and was an officer in charge of a lot of Indian troops, mainly through the Middle East. And because of that experience, perhaps predictably, I gave him a better understanding, I suppose, of the Indians that he was dealing with. So that by the time he came back, he was a different guy from the one who'd went away. He was more open to change at a time when in Madras itself, British attitudes were actually hardening. So you can immediately see the conflict comes up. Part of that is that he has a fairly, he has a troubled personal life. He was a bit of a loner at university. He didn't go to Oxford or Cambridge like most of them. He went to university up in Scotland, got married quickly. His wife didn't settle down in Madras particularly well, especially when he was away at the war. She leaves. He then gets into a whole series of other sort of difficulties. So he's just a guy who, in a sense, is a loner, but sympathetic to India, understands the cause that Indians are working for, and somehow has to navigate through the Indian police service in South India with that kind of attitude and outlook. So, of course, it immediately sets up conflict, it sets up tension, it sets up all sorts of opportunities to put him into the local community in a way in which other people would not have done. And it just allows him, in a sense, of being a bridge between the hard-line Brits and what's going on in India itself.
Yeah, I like that. I think that that unique objective perspective, you know, from that character is critical because, you know, much has been made over the years on colonialism, kind of the fallacy of Western superiority, the race issues and clashes of culture brought on by, I don't know, empire expansion, I guess. From your perspective, what are the lessons of history? I mean, what are you is there a lesson to be learned through Lefanu?
let me answer that a bit indirectly.
Okay.
One of the nicest and most satisfying reviews I've had is a couple of people in Madras itself, which your listeners will know is now called Chennai, a city of about 12 or 15 million or so down on South India. There's a couple of guys there who write history and heritage columns for a local English language newspaper called The Hindu, which is one of India's best newspapers. And they read the first couple of books, and the comment was, he's got it right. And that was very satisfying because, to me, and one of the other things they said was, there's some good history to learn here. And in that sense, what this is, what these books are now, I think they're in the sort of the newer wave of crime fiction and noir, in that, you know, when you look back on the old stuff, say Dashiell Hammett, Agatha Christie in the UK, all of those sort of things, it was really, the focus was really on the puzzle set in the middle of the story. Hammett was a bit different because he was a bit more colourful, but it was a focus on puzzle and the actual mystery. Of course, what we get now is a lot more discussion about, in a sense, the social settings, the social relationships, and all those sort of things. What I've tried to do with Lefanu is to, in a sense, set up some typologies about not every Brit was anti-Indian. And what I've tried to put in there, I think, is the complexity of what was the colonial setting and the colonial story. There were quite a number of people in South India and India itself who genuinely thought that India should become independent. It was only a question of timing. They were very sympathetic to the local Indian situation and cause. And there were very different ways of dealing with that. What I've tried to demonstrate, I think, Greg, is that, yes, there were some people there who thought very differently. Because when you think about it, any of these offshore situations are really complex. And you can see it now. You know, it sort of disturbs me a bit when we see these sort of descriptions about whole blocks of people. You know, Muslims do this, Muslims do that. Well, of course, there's a whole series of subsets in that get blunted off by those general descriptions. And I suppose what I've tried to do with Lefanu is to try and show that there were different opinions on both sides of the colonial fence, and that there were ways of trying to get better understanding through that. And in that sense, I think there are some lessons that, yeah, they might be demonstrated. Whether they're learned or not, of course, is an entirely different question. But I think people are able to actually see that there were some complexities in there and some opportunities that perhaps are not more broadly recognized.
Well, it's nice to, you know, see those complexities and nuances. because, you know, to your point, they're there. The broad descriptions don't make those go away. Fascinating. What would you say a writer should take into consideration when creating a series character like Lafano?
We were talking a little bit about this off air. I think there's two divisions in this. One is the practical. One thing I did get right when I started to write the series was that I thought very carefully about the time frame over which I could run it and relate it to the age of Lafano. So that by the time when we first meet Lafano, he's in his late 30s. That would give him about 20 years or so of active service left under the retirement rules that operated at that time. So that allowed me a lot of scope to put a lot of books in. I actually learned that off Ian Rankin, the great Scottish writer, whose Rebus series, you know, some of your listeners will know about. I think it was the second last one before Exit Music. The story was that a police officer discovered, who was an avid reader, discovered that Rebus would have to retire very soon, and that would, of course, set off all kinds of problems. So I worked that out. What I didn't work out was that, of course, the more books you write in a series, the more complex is the background. And I kind of wish I'd kept a spreadsheet of, you know, character development and story development and situations and all those sort of things as a ready reference now for writing the next ones. But beyond that, I think it's probably, and you know this, I think, probably maybe better than anyone, is that trying to, the central character is, it's okay. You can always dream up a lot of things around that. But it's, in a sense, the permanent secondary characters who, in a sense, you have to develop, but in a way that they don't sort of take the full focus away from the main protagonist. So there's some balancing acts to be done in there. And the additional thing for me is that trying to think about the settings into which I can put these characters and what was the flavour of the time. So the historical crime fiction has that additional bit about, you know, what are the, you know, in a practical sense, how can I get these people into different situations and different locations without stretching credibility too much?
Some excellent advice. Your latest release in the series is A Straight Settlement. Can you tell our listeners a bit about that one? Kind of set up the premise of the book for them.
That's a neat continuation from the previous question, because The Straight Settlement refers to yet another part of the British Empire. It was across the Bay of Bengal, and the Straight Settlements were cities that we now know as Singapore, which everyone will know, Malacca, and Penang, which is now part of Malaysia. Well, so is Malacca. And it was three very tiny states that the British controlled directly there, as opposed to what were called the Federated Malay States that they ruled indirectly through the local sultans. And for a long time, Penang was effectively run from Madras until the early 19th century, and then it became one of these, part of this other entity. And Lafano goes across there to follow an escaped suspect. And he's effectively running two sorts of cases. One is on a missing senior British official who's decamped. Govery's heading to Singapore with some looted art treasures taken out of local temples. And the second one, he's following up on a murder victim who turned up in Madras, but in fact with the son of a major Singapore merchant. And that's convenient to get Lefanu out of Madras because he's in huge conflict with his superior officer, who's come back from the UK to take over substantively the position that Lefanu was holding. So the government decides to get Lefanu out of Madras, across the Bay of Bengal, into the Strait Settlement, and of course that allows me to go into another set of colonial arrangements which talked about China, and of Hong Kong and China operating in Southeast Asia, and a whole set of other different, in a sense, storyline tensions. So that's roughly the context in which it all happens.
You've got a rich sandbox to play in there for sure. I mean, that's you can I can see these stories continuing for, you know, for a long time in the future to come. Brian, you're not only a writer of fiction, as you mentioned. I would say almost, you know, first and foremost, you have a pretty extensive list of nonfiction titles. Tell us a bit about your nonfiction.
As I mentioned at the top, I think, Greg, I started life, obviously, my professional life as an academic, as an historian, basically social scientist. And so all of my earlier work was basically around that, but it deviated from being only about India. I grew up, like a lot of New Zealanders, passionately interested in sport. Played a lot of rugby down here, played a lot of cricket, golf, tennis, you know, all of the usual things. But when I started training as an historian, I started rereading all my sports books in a very different way and started to think about sport as a social system and started to write about it, and wrote about it in history and sociology. And I wrote a book called Saturday Afternoon Fever, which was really an investigation of the role of sport in Australian culture. And that took me to work in Canberra in Australia at the very time the Australian Institute of Sport was set up. And I set up Australia's first sports management degree at the University of Canberra and one of the world's first sports media degrees. And that took me into sports journalism and a whole set of other things. So a lot of the work I did was really around the politics and the economics and sort of the cultural structure of sport. And among other things, I went and I played my last year of competitive cricket actually in the Caribbean. I played in Barbados, co-wrote a book on the role of cricket in Caribbean culture with now Sir Hilary Beckles, who's the president of the University of the West Indies. So I did a lot of that stuff, wrote a lot about Indian history on the period that I'd done. Then when I started doing all of this aid and development work, I started to switch it. And one of the books I've had the most fun out of doing was the memoir on Damascus. It's called A House in Damascus Before the Fall. And it's a series of essays that consider who had been in Damascus and in Syria historically. And people like Mark Twain went there. Mark Twain didn't like it very much, but I think that was because he was pretty sick. And, I mean, everybody had been there because it was one of the great destinations. And it was just one of my ambitions to go there, and I never really thought I'd have the chance, and then I got to go and work there. And putting that book together sort of opened it up into a very different, opened my writing into a very different vein. So I did that. I've done a series of essays in contemporary India, done a lot of stuff in the international politics and relations of sport. I now write, in addition to the fiction work, I write for still an academic vein, but a kind of popular column on international relations and politics for a group called the Global Policy Journal that's based in the UK. So one of the great things about doing all of that sort of different work is that it teaches you an enormous amount about audience. So among the other things I do, I do cruise lectures, mainly for Holland America, which a number of your listeners may know about. And again, it's mm-hmm. it's about how do you tune things to a different audience? And I've been very lucky to learn that through these different experiences. So, yeah, the writing's covered a vast array of things, but they all kind of interact at one point.
Yeah, and I would say that the fiction writing probably uses a different muscle, if I'm venturing a guess. Do you approach the fiction writing differently? And what does it look like for you? Do you outline your plots or just kind of jump right in and start typing away to see where the story takes you? How does that work for you?
Okay, one of the advantages of starting with the India that I knew was that it cut down the amount of research that I had to do as an historical crime writer. And it also allowed me to think very differently about how I'd approach it. So the first one, I literally sat down, I think I wrote the draft about 8 days. And that came pretty easily. So getting all of that there was actually surprisingly, I was a little bit surprised about how, I wouldn't say easily, but how readily it came along. And that was, in retrospect, that was because I'd gone through this transition from very straight line academic writing through to more generalized writing, say through the memoir and through the biography. And there was a natural transition yeah. then through into this other activity. But I think you're really onto something, because the difference for me, I found the time I went back to Madras, now Chennai, having started to write the fiction, was very different, because I got in one of those little motorized buggies, the tuk-tuk, and just rode around Madras for about a week, really seeing it in a different through a different lens, because I'd tracked the city following particular political events in the 1920s. But I was now seeing it in a much broader way, and I was trying to think about social patterns and social relationships in a very different way. So in that sense, it was using the material and my knowledge of India in a very different way to set up these other stories. Strangely enough, the consequence of this, Greg, is that I'm currently putting together a true crime book set here in New Zealand from the late 19th century. And I thought, I've written something like 15 or 16 books of nonfiction. I'm actually finding this one a little bit difficult to put together, because I'm now having to switch out of that fiction back into a very strict discipline of the nonfiction stuff, which is ordering the evidence and putting the story and plot together, putting the plot together, but it's actually not a plot, it's a true story. So switching brains backwards has actually been a lot more difficult than I'd anticipated. So it's an interesting consequence of having spent the last few years writing the fiction. I'm now going back to something that I thought I'd find easy, and I'm not.
Yeah. Funny. Different side of the brain, maybe.
Exactly.
Which authors would you say, which authors would you say, fiction-wise, have had the most influence on you, Brian?
Oh, that's a fabulous question. I'll start more generally. I mean, coming from New Zealand, obviously, we're in that sort of Anglo-imperial mode. So I first looked at a lot of the English writers, but one of the first for me, and I've actually, you grow up and you read these different things, and I suppose it's the power of language and the creation of imagery. But one of the first influences was A.A. Milne, with the great Winnie the Pooh books. Now, theoretically, they're for kids, but I think adults get way more out of them. And I've now gone on and bought some first editions of those. But if I go, then it was people like Robert Louis Stevenson, you know, historical crime, if you like it, and adventure stories and those sort of things, taking me through into coming to write the crime fiction. Ian Rankin, obviously, I think one of the great masters, Dashiell Hammett, Michael Connelly, if I think on the American side, Sarah Paretsky, those sort of people strictly in the crime vein. But I'm now, over the last few years, I've read a lot of stuff out of Europe and Asia and Africa, people like Fred Vargas in France, Parker Bilal, whose work is set in Cairo, so all of those. But then in the background, there's a whole set of other writers as well. You know, you go back to people like Mark Twain, and actually I was reminded of Mark Twain about a week ago. My wife and I are huge fans of Jimmy Buffett, and Jimmy was playing in Christchurch, New Zealand, and it was wonderful because the tour that he was doing was effectively following Mark Twain's world tour of the late 19th century. And we were in the very hall in Christchurch that Mark Twain had performed in back at that time. So there was this wonderful connection about, you know, contemporary popular culture going back to popular culture of over a century ago, and there it was sort of all wrapped up. So I've always read those sort of people. I'm a great fan of people like Evelyn Waugh. People basically who are fantastic wordsmiths. And for me, that's the real trick. You know, you read someone who really knows what they're doing and knows how to paint a picture with words. That's the stuff that gets me in and has a big influence on me as well. Because it's a skill that you're trying to convey a whole set of images to a reader, and the people who do that really well, to me, are just inspirational.
Excellent. So what advice would you give to someone, say they're sitting down tonight to write their first novel? What would you think they should know as they start out as a writer?
Well, I suppose there's two or three things that people always, and I'm just thinking off the top of my head. I divide it up into what I'd probably call the professional and the practical. The professional is know that, first of all, do it because you want to do it, not because you think it's actually going to make you a stack load of money. You've got to have a commitment to it and have an idea about satisfying your own curiosity and your own, I suppose, your own ambition to get something written. And it doesn't have to be large. You can do that pretty readily. I mean, I talk to people a lot and they say, look, if you start out and write 100 words a day, at the end of a week, you've got close to 1,000. That's a good start. And as students, I think we learn that. You graduate your way through the original essay right up to a PhD thesis. It's all part of a process by which you learn how to do the craft. So that thing is, in a sense, linking again to your previous question, Greg, about, you know, keep reading and keep investing. Keep exploring, because watching how other people do it is one of the greatest reminders that you can have about the discipline of the craft. So all of that stuff is really significant. The practical, I think, is to, if you're really serious about this and you want to get to an audience, then really understand the practical world into which you're going. You know, because publishing now is very different from what it was even 10 or 15 years ago. the whole world of agents and publishers and all of that, my advice would be get to know it earlier rather than later, and get curious about that professional world of publishing and understand what the game's about. And there's some pretty easy ways of doing that.
I think that's some great advice, Brian. Thank you for sharing that. So for you, upcoming, what you mentioned the nonfiction true crime book in New Zealand. What other new and exciting projects are you working on these days that we can look forward to seeing?
Well, there is. I'm doing another Lefanu. I'm not quite sure where he's going to be in the timetable, but I've got about 40,000 words of Lefanu 4 written. Again, I'm looking forward to getting that done. I'm also playing around with some film and television scripts as well. A couple of those are a little bit more contemporary. Again, one or two of them draw on the historical precedent. And again, it's trying to learn some new ways of doing the craft. Investigating some new opportunities because there are some great things out there. And again, that allows you to approach things in a very different way. I mean, I've done like a lot of people, I suppose, and probably even amongst your listeners, I've done a few film and screenwriting courses. And I now look at the series that you see in a very different way because I'm looking at it, I think, with a little bit more insight in about how they're put together. Talking to quite a few people here in New Zealand about that. I've got some great colleagues who write fiction but also do screenplays and those sort of things. So, again, it's part of the professional curiosity, I think, that keeps us all going as writers.
That's great. I mean, that's some good things to look forward to. In the days to come. So Brian, where's the best place that can find you out there on the web and keep up with your work?
Two things. Predictably, all the books themselves are on Amazon. And the second is I do have a website, which is www.brianstoddartwriter.com. And I put on a whole bunch of things on there that sort of sometimes they're rambles, and they're not done every day. I've just come off the back end of about 4 months of absolutely frenetic activity of a couple of lecture cruises that took us back up through Asia and across into a couple of other places, and that led to spending a little bit more time back in India. I've got one or two other professional commitments around, so the website tends to get neglected from time to time, but there's a whole bunch of sort of backstories there that will give people some ideas that about what I've been up to and what I'm doing, and in a sense how I approach things. And I love connecting to people, so my email address is on there, and if they want to drop me a line, I'm very happy to correspond.
Oh, that's great. So brianstoddartwriter.com, did I get that right?
That's the one.
Okay, and then amazon.com. Well, Brian, you know, man, the time passes so fast, but thanks so much for coming on the show and talking to us about your work. I mean, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on, and I say let's do this again when you have the fourth Lefanu come out.
Oh, look, that would be wonderful, Greg. And look, it's been fantastic to talk to you there in Kentucky. I really appreciate the opportunity. And it's just great to swap some ideas and make some new connections. So thank you very much. And thanks to the listeners for being there.
Well, you're welcome. And as for the listeners, I encourage you to check out Brian Stoddart's Lefanu series. They're out from the excellent publisher Crime Wave Press. And they are, again, A Madras Miasma, The Palin Poor Predicament, and A Straight Settlement. You can find them all easily on Amazon. And while you're at it, keep an eye out for my upcoming release, Everglade, which is the fifth and last volume in the Selena series, and it's going to be out this summer. Until then, All Due Respect Books is running a sale on the first book in the series, Selena, and it's available in e-copy for 99 cents. You can find it on Amazon, but here's the trick. If you go to that site and search for Selena, you're going to unlock a gold mine of Selena Gomez products that you might find enjoyable, but if you're looking for my book, search for Greg Barth, and you'll be in the right neighborhood. Until next time, this is Greg Barth with Noir on the Radio saying peace out. In case you're wondering, Noir on the Radio is a copyrighted podcast solely owned by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC.